Do you remember what we were? Do you remember the
at
project?
At the Luton Palace, we were talking about a rock musical based on the life of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah,
right.
Saucy Jack.
Saucy Jack. Now is the time to do
you're
that.
You're a naughty one. Saucy Jack. You're a haughty one. Saucy Jack.
Right.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
You're a naughty one, Saucy Jack, you're a haughty one. Saucy Jack, when the street lamp's gaslight flickers and fails, then you see the last light glinting off the entrails. Oh, naughty, 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 you're a sneaky one. A Saucy Jack, you're a cheeky one. Saucy Jack.
We've touched on this earlier, but let's dig into it now. You're of the opinion that Holmes was involved with the Jack the Ripper murders. I think your estimation is that it wasn't necessarily Holmes himself, but maybe Holmes and his assistant, or Holmes' assistant. But definitely that there's Holmes' fingerprints on the Jack the Ripper murders. And of course, the Jack the Ripper story is infamous and legendary. So I guess. You know, do you want to make the case for this? Tell me why you think this is the case. We know that he was in England at the time, right?
Well, no, I can't prove he was in London at the time based on a ship back and forth. We can prove that he was in London based on the letters that were written, because it would have been impossible for him to have written them anywhere else but in London.
Right, right.
Which the Jack the Ripperologists, the guys that spend their lives as a hobby working on Jack the Ripper, and I have full admiration for them. That's not enough for them. Why, I don't know. But I can tell you, if your listeners go to my website, bloodstainsthebook.com, they'll see the video of when I gave the talk at the TED. The TED allowed me to present the evidence to the audience and then ask them to vote as my grand jury based on that evidence, like I did as a prosecutor in California, whether there was probable cause that Holmes was Jack the Ripper and guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. So the vote came out a vast majority in our favor. It was wonderful to see. Now, if you also go on the website, you'll see the various pieces of evidence. Up on the first page, if you scroll down, you'll see the various pieces of evidence.
Yeah, so, bloodstainsthebook.com is the website, folks.
Yeah, and your listeners don't have to buy the book when they go on there, but check the evidence out. It's a great, infamous historical piece, perhaps the greatest mystery of all time. And we're presenting evidence, Tim, which if you gave me the same evidence right now in a current murder trial in California, Tim,
mm-hmm.
I'd get a conviction for you. And it's only because people have such closed minds and perspectives about Jack the Ripper that they won't consider this evidence. And when they give me the chance, coming on shows like yours, they'll see the Dear Boss letter, the most famous letter of all the Ripper letters, the only one that's really authentic. I'll give you a great example.
Yeah.
Dear Boss, Tim, was written before the fourth Ripper murder, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now grab that number, fourth of the five.
Right.
There was never a Jack the Ripper, the first three murders. It was created the fourth because of Dear Boss, which is signed Jack the Ripper.
Right.
Now, most people don't realize that. To me, it's astounding still that history just glosses over that fact. So, it was signed Jack the Ripper. It was delivered to the London media, who contacted Scotland Yard and the London Metropolitan Police, who ordered the media not to publicize the letter because the letter described the condition of the next victim. And 2 days later, Catherine Eddowes was discovered, Tim, with that condition.
Right.
The ear was removed. Then Scotland Yard allowed the media to present that letter to the public on the first page of their paper. So after the body was found, it was published to the public. The letter was written before she was killed. When we saw that, my friend in Pennsylvania, Mark Potts, took the letter, Dear Boss, and the archives of Holmes at the University of Michigan to the British Library, whose expert, and we have her opinion, stated that they were the same. The same guy wrote the London, the Dear Boss letter that wrote the letters, the Holmes letters at the University of Michigan. Well, having practiced criminal law, I knew the Supreme Court was iffy about expert opinions on handwriting.
Right.
So I also knew that the FBI and the Department of Justice was using a corporation in the University of Buffalo that had created this computer program that would run a million points through each letter on a program to discover similarity on handwriting. I contacted them. They were juiced. They wanted to help us. We sent them the best copy of the Dear Boss letter we could get. London wouldn't give us the original for obvious reasons.
Right, right.
We sent them the archives from University of Michigan, and they came back with 97% similarity, Tim, and I explained that on the bloodstainsthebook.com first page.
Yeah.
They also said that if we funded their effort, allowing them to create the font at the turn of the century that was used, the same letter font, they were convinced they could get 100%. So that now we know who wrote the Dear Boss letter. It was Holmes who was teasing the media and law enforcement regarding the three murders before committed of London prostitutes. Scotland Yard, when I contacted them, Tim, told me that they had been convinced for decades that Jack the Ripper was at least two or three copycats, and that the author of the Dear Boss letter had been an American trying to sound English. They didn't even use boss in the English nomenclature back then. That was a word used by Americans to describe the head of a union. So then you have Jack the Ripper, perhaps the greatest marketing tool ever invented, ever. And what the Ripperologists do now, Tim, when I go on shows, when I go to the TED, when I do debates, they try to get away from the fact that the author of Dear Boss was the murderer by explaining it was a journalist trying to sell papers, which I then raise, what about the ear?
Yeah.
When he described the next body will have her left ear removed. And they have no answer, Tim, and it's too much of a coincidence for me. It's certainly too much of a coincidence to not take to a jury in a criminal murder trial today for a current murder.
Right, right. It's very intriguing stuff. I mean, I believe, like I said before, I was asking you if the Holmes death hoax, let's say, had been advanced before, but I believe the idea that it was Holmes has been around sort of in the annals of Ripperology, right? He's kind of been a sort of peripheral suspect, right?
I wasn't the first to bring him up. I've been the first to go in front of a group like the TED. I was the first to go on History Channel. History Channel allowed me to present the evidence that he was Jack the Ripper. So when we started this, Tim, people would laugh me off. They're not laughing anymore, and I'm pretty convinced Netflix is going to use Bloodstains to work the story that Holmes was Jack the Ripper. So, you know, it's a piece of evidence. Well, and like the computer composite on the first page of my website. In 2006, Tim, I'll get off the track a little bit where you went, but in 2006, Scotland Yard and the BBC ran the 13 eyewitness testimonies through their computer to create that composite that's on my page.
Right.
And we ran the photo of Holmes up alongside it. And you can see, your listeners can go on there and take a look. It's on the first page. Just scroll down a little bit. Yep. We took that composite, Tim, to the guy at the FBI that retired that did that for a living. He was like, oh, it's very similar, very similar. He was, you know, he was playing the game. But then he stopped cold in his tracks, Tim, and he said, wait a minute. Look at the nose. The bridge of the nose is broken in exactly the same place. Then he started looking back through the evidence, Tim, himself. And he's like, wait a minute. The same age, the same height, the same weight? This is too much. And I'm telling you, I watched the guy at his desk roll over on that composite. So will I ever be able to prove precisely he was Jack the Ripper, Tim? No. No, I wouldn't be able to do it, Tim, if I came on a show and gave a video that an alien took of one of the murders, all right? You know that.
Get that video. Please come on my show with that.
I'll go on your show, buddy. And you know, the Ripperologists, they're going to find some way to tell me no. But I'll tell you this, Tim. If we get to where people will open their minds and consider the evidence, they'll see we've got this backwards. It shouldn't be me trying to prove H.H. Holmes was Jack the Ripper who committed two or three murders, Tim. It should be London and the British trying to prove Jack the Ripper was this horrible monster that lived in America.
Right, right. Is it even, I mean, I think I had a Jack the Ripper guest on a few years ago, and I think I raised this point, but it's like, is it even possible at this point even to prove anything with the Jack the Ripper story, or is it just all, is it always going to be sort of like this, this debated idea, you know what I mean? Is it something that can ever be proven anyway?
No, I mean, you've got, well, I can only tell you this, Tim, I could take this evidence and get a conviction today, all
right?
Right, I could get a guy sent to death with this evidence. Now, if that's not enough, I give up. There's nothing more I can do except that shows like yours, the TED, my offer to debate anyone in the world, Tim, I'll go to Harvard, I'll go to Yale, I'll go to the London University, I'll debate the evidence in front of a crowd of lawyers and judges. I'll debate it in front of a group of FBI agents. We'll go into the forensics. And you know what, Tim, I'll guarantee you they'll come away scratching their head. This is good stuff.
It's pretty compelling stuff. I mean, based on the fact that, like you said, we're because of the way he sent the letters from England, we know he was in the area. So it's not like leap of faith where you're saying like that some dude, we have no idea if he was in England at all. It's like, we know he was there, so.
And you know what? You brought up a great point that I missed. When you have the Dear Boss letter and you have the date, all right, that's postmarked in London. That still doesn't prove it. He could have sent it from the United States and had it postmarked in London. Now, the body was found 2 days later. 2 days after that, it was published in the London papers. 2 days after that, the Saucy Jack postcard was written exclaiming and describing the murder again and the Dear Boss letter. Tim, it took 8 or 9 days to get across the Atlantic. It's impossible for him not to have been in London.
Right. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Well, you couldn't really fake that from America.
It's impossible.
Complicated, yeah.
There were no airplanes.
It's pretty creepy stuff. Why did he, in your estimation, why would he even... He's got a good thing going, no pun intended, or for lack of a better term, he's got a good thing going here in America. Why'd he even go to England to do this stuff?
You know, the greatest, I've thought about that. It's a wonderful question. The greatest scientists in the world were in London at the time, the ones leading the forefront of medicine, of science, of longevity, all those things. Holmes was an elegant man, Tim, who was the master of life insurance fraud. Here was a man making $300,000 or $400,000 a year. He dressed elegant. He had assistants with him. He had the cases. He loved Paris, Berlin, London. We have a letter that he wrote to his lawyer, not during the Ripper murders, but after, stating that he didn't like London because he couldn't get the New York Herald, his favorite paper, there. We have that letter. This was a man who loved to travel. And why he would have been in London at the time, you know, he might have had a woman there, Tim. I don't know. He might have been looking to have a meeting with one of those scientists, you know, the leading scientists of the world. It's anyone's guess. And like you said earlier, which is a great point to bring up, I'll never be able to prove that.
Right, right. That's the maddening part of the Jack the Ripper mystery in general, where it's like you really can't. You know, as time goes by, you get further and further away from being possible to even prove anything.
Well, and you know, Tim, it's a $1 billion-a-year industry.
That's true. That's true. And
they don't
thinking,
want, they
know,
don't
I
want
mean,
it proven.
Yeah, that's... I guess you're right in a sense. Yeah, that's true. But then, you know, I was just thinking, too, it's like nobody ever foresaw sort of this whole DNA revolution. So who knows? Maybe in like 100 years they'll be able to...
take us back psychically to the time and be able to look precisely at what happened. You know, who knows? You know what I mean? It's
you
like,
know,
you know, who knows what's going to happen in the future where mysteries like this may be able to be answered. Who knows?
You know what? I think, Tim, there's a possibility when we excavate the grounds at the murder castle, and my friend Mark Potts believes, when we excavate those grounds at the murder castle, that post office at 63rd and Wallace, Tim, there's going to be evidence there about him being in London.
Really?
Yeah, and I have nothing to buttress that with, back it up with, although it makes sense. So it'd be interesting to see if the excavation is done properly, if somebody like the Smithsonian gets in there and monitors it so it doesn't turn into a Geraldo Rivera thing, I think we are going to find many new things about American history and maybe Jack the Ripper.
What would it take for them to even – we talked about the excavation of the body, but what would it even – would you have to do that first, you think, to be able to get into the bottom of that basement? I'm just surprised nobody's tried to do this yet in general. Do you know what I mean? Like if the History Channel took you down to the basement, I'm surprised that no one – you know, I mean, for God's sake, they're in a live exorcism on Friday. So it's like I'm surprised nobody's tapped into this potential for a freak show live TV special type thing.
You know, Tim, I think that's just a matter of time. Once that movie comes out, and it might be 2 years from now, once that movie comes out and goes around the world and is seen by billions, the federal government's going to have no choice but to excavate those grounds.
Hmm. Well, yeah, you say that, but you know, the federal government has a way of not doing what you think they should definitely do. So you never know.
You got me there.
You know, if you never count on one entity to do what you think is the right thing to do and not do it, that would be the federal government. So I'll hold out hope, but I'm also, vastly cynical about the federal government's respect for their own responsibility. Now, we sort of danced around this. You want to get into Bloodstains. Obviously, it's your book. Tell us, you know, it's pretty remarkable stuff, Jeff. I mean, you find these diaries that are allegedly that you think are written by Holmes, right? That's the gist of the story. Now, how much of this book is actually what, you know, is actually 100% true? What's the percentage here of, because I was having a little trouble with it. I couldn't really tell if this was sort of a historical fiction, if this was, if you were sort of doing a what-if thing. I really couldn't really tell exactly what was going on with the book, and that's partially my own fault, you know, because I just didn't really – I should have asked you maybe before I started reading the book. But what's the sort of makeup of this book?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'll answer you one question about that subject, okay? Because – as on the front of my book, I say based on a true story. And
right, exactly. So,
when I published the book, my lawyers and I went through this. And when an author writes a historical piece, one of the toughest decisions they have to make is calling it nonfiction or based on a true story. Because you get into libel and slander and lawsuits and those things. And, Tim, I can't prove everything in my book. I can't prove he's not buried in Philadelphia. I can't prove that he's Jack the Ripper. I can't prove a number of things in that book. But I tell you what, as time goes by, each of them will be proven. Now, what you can say as a reader, whether what's true and what's not, I tell you what I do is I ask my readers to do this. Pick the book up. Look at it as a novel. Read the novel, but place yourselves in my shoes at that dinner party when your grandfather tells you the truth.
Mm.
Go through the story. Go all the way to the end. You get halfway through, and it's a tough story. I mean, we're talking about a little girl in the basement with her father, the detective from Chicago.
Yeah, that's a crazy story.
And Holmes torturing them both. And I can tell you this, that's a true story. But I can tell you this, that's a tough one to keep going. And I try to get my readers to keep going because the end is a great part of my story. And it becomes the relationship between my grandfather and I and how this man that I pretty much hated my early life turns into this man that I admired for the secret he kept and the protection he gave his family from this horrible story. And And when you see that ending, and you'll know that we're going to prove this story true, it's just a matter of time.
Right, right. Well, I guess one of the things that troubled me, I guess, reading the book is I looked on the website, I read the book, obviously. There's no like reproduction of these diaries. There's no photographs of them anywhere. I mean, do you have any sort of like place where people can see these things to know for a fact that you actually even got them in the first place? I mean, it's a pretty obvious question to ask. So, you know, I don't feel like I'm putting you on the spot. So where can we see these diaries so we know that you actually got them?
Never. There's a picture of the ammunition cases they came in. You'll never see the diaries, and I'll give you three words, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this will be the last I answer about this question on advice of counsel. Statute of limitations. They involve homicides, all right?
Mm-hmm. Homicides committed by Holmes?
Yes, and they would be confiscated immediately. So I'm going to tell you right now, Tim, they're false. I made them up.
What do you mean by that?
Just what I told you.
So you're saying that you didn't get these diaries?
No, I'm telling you statute of limitations.
You're confusing me, Jeff.
They would be evidence. Tim, if they existed?
Yeah.
Come on. Jump with me on this.
I'm on the ledge with you, brother. Come on.
If they existed, they wouldn't be mine.
I suppose, but couldn't you just take the diaries?
Nope. That's as far as I can go, Tim. I've done this for 4 years now.
Okay? I understand. Yeah. I understand. I'll just get
And you know what? And I tell everybody, when you read the book, just pick it up as a novel. Don't believe any of it. Pick it up as a novel.
All right. I'll just say this, okay? You don't have to respond. This is just my advice, okay? I'm not counsel, so my advice isn't as valuable as that. But if you're worried about them taking the shit away from you, I would just take them and scan them and PDF them and throw them out there on the web and let everybody have them. And then if they take them, they take them. They're still out there. So it's not like you're going to lose them. That's what I would do personally. But, you know, I can see how if they're real and you have them, they'd be a valuable sort of family heirloom. You wouldn't want someone to take them away from you. And you might be concerned about sort of whatever supernatural connection there may be to them, where you wouldn't want someone to get their hands on them for fear of what would happen to them. But to me, I feel like personally, your story is really compelling. I would love to be able to see these things so that you would shut up the haters. You know what I mean? I'm sure you'd like to shut up the haters.
No, I'm not concerned at all. I'm doing fine. When has a novelist been asked to present at the TED? When has a novelist been asked to present it in Michigan, in Chicago, in New York City, in San Francisco, in L.A., evidence to a crowd of law enforcement? It's fine. I'm doing fine with it. And when we prove each piece of evidence, everyone will know I couldn't have made this story up. So anyway, that's as far as I can go. But you know, your questions are great, and I don't mind them at all. I used to mind them a lot.
Right, right. I mean, you can see my perspective.
I'm fine with it now.
I hope you can see my perspective. It's like
sure.
I want to give you the benefit of the doubt. It's like if somebody has.
That's why I call it based on a true story. I let my readers decide.
All right. Okay. Well, it sounds like you don't want to go any further on sort of the diary part as far as, like, what the deal is, so I won't push you any harder. I won't push you any harder on that. But, Dory, you find these diaries, and that's what sort of turns you on to this possibility that he faked his death, and that's sort of what set you down this whole path in the first place, right?
You know what, Jim? I'll tell you something. Faking the death, until I prove... And this is a piece of evidence that history has in its hands, Tim. I'm not making this up. Until I prove that it's not him in that concrete, all your questions about afterwards, the world will consider crazy. Me crazy, not you. Me, okay? When we prove it's not him, I'm on the road. And that's what I need to do. And that's what I've decided will be the next step. When that concrete comes up and the Smithsonian says, you know what, Mudgett was right. That's not him. That's not his DNA. then all the stuff that I've been called crazy about for 3 years now will, I hope someone has the courage to stand up and eat their words. I, knowing, like you said, our society, I doubt it. But I hope someone has the courage to stand up and eat their words. We'll see.
Right, right. Well, it's a very, like I said, it adds a whole interesting layer to all this. Now, what's the, you say you need $100,000, what, to get the concrete out of the ground?
You know, the court proceedings, you've got to file the motion. You've got to hire the lawyers in Pennsylvania. You've got to go through all that stuff. It's going to be appealed by anyone supposedly in my family line. You've got to go through that. It might take 2 or 3 years, and then you've got to arrange that it be done scientifically, that the Smithsonian agrees to. And all of a sudden, Tim, you're talking about $2,000 an hour.
What? I see. So the lawyers and shit like that.
Well, or the excavation.
Right.
The exhumation. You've got guys walking around with gloves and masks and the whole stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the DNA, it's not... I learned, you know that latest thing last year, Tim, about the Ripper and the guy proving who the Ripper was because of the DNA on the shawl, and it was shown that was a bunch of malarkey?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what you learned if you followed that story closely was DNA is not some four-day deal. It took 6 months for them to run that third and fourth degree DNA down to prove it was wrong.
Right.
And it's expensive. And that's the stuff I'm going to have to write a check to unless I can get a History Channel or a sci-fi channel to step up to the plate. Now, I'm hoping that happens.
Well, you know, if the movie proves out to be super popular, like I said, I mean, they're doing an exorcism on Friday, so I can't see how much farther behind something like that could be to exhume H.H. Maybe that'll be next Halloween's big special.
Wouldn't that be something?
You should get in touch with the people doing the exorcism.
Where are they doing that?
Destination America.
Destination America. They're doing an exorcism of Holmes?
No. They're doing just a live exorcism.
Oh, okay.
On
all right.
Friday
I
night.
Will.
So you should be like, hey, man, you think that's crazy? I got a story for you. Help me get my great-grandfather exhumed. Do you have any idea who this dude is in the concrete? Do you have any theory about who that might be?
You know, I think it's his guard, but I can't prove it, and I doubt we ever will be able to. The DNA, you know, will establish that it's not Holmes, but who it is, I don't know if you could. I'm not an expert in DNA. I don't know how much it tells you. I do know it will tell us it's not my DNA, that's for sure.
Right, obviously, yeah, yeah. But you have no indication from your... from your research?
No.
From
the chapter in my book is theory. In the book, I theorize that it is the guard that was hung in his place, but I can't prove that. No.
Okay. Well, it's very interesting. I mean, that part of the story, the idea that the death was faked, is pretty remarkable. I mean, it adds up in a lot of ways. It's very shady. The whole thing went down very shady, so it's like, what is really going on here with this dude, you know, unless it's like sort of a Hannibal Lecter thing where they were like so put off by how evil he was that they just didn't want to even, you know what I mean, where they had him strapped up and masked and all that shit.
Could be. You could be right on. And like I say, Tim, it's one of those great things in history that we can prove. It's there. We know exactly where it is. I mean, I was there last year at the gravesite with some friends, and it's the cemetery fakes where he is unless you can prove you have a connection because they have people visiting it all the time.
Right, right. Yeah, I read that part.
And, you know, we went back, and it's an amazing picture. I don't know if you've seen it on my Facebook page, but the tree that's over the gravesite that I write about in the book is the only one that's been repeatedly struck by lightning. It's like just totally, like you say, shady is a great word, spooky. But it's really, really spooky to see. The other trees are just pure trees, pure oak trees, or whatever, elm, or whatever you guys call Pennsylvania trees. I'm not an expert arborist. But this one is just shattered, repeated strikes. It's an amazing thing to see.
Well, there's certainly, you know, makes you wonder, like, talk about possession and stuff. It really makes you wonder how you know, what was going on with this guy. You know what I mean? It's like, was he truly evil in an evil, you know, you talked about what drove him in the book. You say that's what you were sort of striving for in the book. It's like, it's just remarkable, like, what could possess somebody, no pun intended, to be so evil.
I think he enjoyed it. I think he had a choice, and that's one of the reasons I go on shows like yours, Tim, to be able to explain to your listeners that this malarkey, this baloney, that people, you know, try to say that this evil is some disease or condition we have in our head. Look at my family. No one after him. Here, we came from the most evil thing that ever lived, and no one in my family even jaywalked. All right, two were war heroes. One was a mayor in Florida. They're all good American taxpayers. They all made choices to be good. And this man came from a good family. He made a choice to be evil. And I like to be able to stand up in front of crowds like yours and say, this stuff, when you go on and you see these doctors, you know, trying to make excuses for these killers is baloney. They made choices. They wanted to hurt someone and be evil. And I think if that's the only thing we prove from Bloodstains and Holmes, the history of Holmes, that's enough right there, Tim. It's enough for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's pretty twisted. You wonder why this, it's just disappointing, I guess. You know, it's like someone with that great an intellect would turn to evil. It's like, why would you do that, dude? He could have really changed the world in a positive way, but who knows? You know, just very dark. It's scary stuff. Now, while you were sort of doing all the book chronicles, you know, you're doing this investigation, you kind of like, well, obviously you developed some illness here, and it's also, it sort of raises the question in the book, is all this stuff happening because of your illness, or is it because of your possession of these diaries? Sort of a thriller in a way. It's very remarkable in that sense. I really like that part of the book.
Thanks. I give my readers the opportunity. Many of my neurologists believed it had to do with my epilepsy, Tim, and nothing to do with Holmes.
Right. But you kind of leave it up to people to decide for themselves in a way, which I kind of like, you know. It's very
well. It's like people today, the ones that believe in paranormal and the ones that don't, Tim. I mean, there's no reason why some do and some don't. It's you know, it kind of defines who we are as separate human beings, if you ask me.
Hmm. Now, let me think here for a minute what direction we want to go in next. Well, I guess talk a little bit about sort of what was happening. What's that?
I hate to interrupt you, but how much more we got to go, my friend?
About 45 minutes.
I don't know if I'll be able to go that long. I have to go get some more medicine for that condition we talked about. How long have we been on the show
for
now?
We've been on for about an hour and 18 minutes. You want to wrap it up at 90 minutes?
Sure, that'd be great.
Sounds good.
That.
Well, I guess talk a little bit about sort of that what you were going through during the book. I mean, tell people about that experience. Cause I mean, you're hearing voices, you really seem to go through a metamorphosis. I mean, at one point I wasn't sure it sounds like you were, you know, driven to almost kill at one point or several points in the book. So I guess talk a little bit about that. I mean, that's a pretty remarkable experience to go through.
Yeah. The voices were there. I try to explain how, you know, I woke up in the back of an ambulance, being told that I was dead, and they had revived me, which, from a condition I'd never had before, I learned about Holmes and had started my research and investigation. There are many of my friends believe that it's completely involves, you know, Holmes and my change in life. As you discussed earlier, and this I think is enough for someone listening that might want to read the book, Tim, I give them the opportunity. There's a path. They can take, I explain exactly how the neurologist explained my condition and how they believe there was a tumor in my head, which wasn't there before I learned about H.H. Holmes.
Right.
And then others, you know, I give the opportunity to explain that when I went down into that basement and saw what the murder castle looked like, having never seen a picture, and then have those images turn out to be true, I don't believe in images, Tim. I don't believe in visions or voices, all right? But those things, those facts, which slap you on the face, are hard to get around sometimes. And I try to let my readers have the choice in the book. And I'm glad you think it was a thriller, because that's what I wanted to write. And the only way it's proven, Tim, and this is what you and I got into earlier, when those remains are dug up, when we prove that he was Jack the Ripper, when that excavation happens at 63rd and Wallace, I'm going to get to stand back and say, I told you. And until then, I can't. I go on shows, and you know what? I don't have. When I first started this, Tim, I had hosts like yours that would say that they thought I was crazy, goofy, that stuff. I don't get that anymore because they know, you know, you don't get asked to go give a presentation on the TED if you're a goofy writer.
Right, right.
They're very careful who they ask. They're very careful who they review their evidence. I don't get to go. You don't get to go on the History Channel and on national TV. Those things. So it's turning the corner, and I think Jack the Ripper's only a matter of time. I mean, the stuff you and I discussed about the Dear Boss letter. I get excited as all heck about that. I love going on a show like yours and explaining. There wasn't even a Jack the Ripper the first three murders.
Right.
That's just what ripperologists, historians, and authors have worked backwards to make the story sell, and what the London media people did to sell papers.
Well,
I find that amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable stuff. I mean, this dude was a character, for lack of a better term. He was quite the character. It's funny too. You look at the picture of him, and he's a creepy looking dude. But like for the time, he wasn't. You know, people need to know that. You know what I mean? It's like he looks. If you saw a dude looking like that, like nowadays, you'd walk to the other side of the street. But back in the day, he sort of was like quite the charmer.
Yeah, I don't know. If he had his hair done modern, his, you know, and his mustache shaved off, and he had some,
it's the mustache,
had a Tommy
really,
Tommy
yeah.
Bahama shirt on, and you know, and carrying a gimlet in his hand, he'd probably get by.
I suppose. It's that mustache, dude. That's a
that was pretty common back then.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust a dude with a mustache like that nowadays. He'd be a hipster.
Yeah, are there any movie stars that wear that mustache anymore? I'm not sure they do.
Only porn stars.
There you go.
Well, how do you have any sort of like funding set aside yet for this potential have you done any sort of steps to, you know, you're saying you need the money and everything, but it's like, let's say they drop the money on you tomorrow. Could you just, what would be the plan of action here? I mean, do you have it sort of ready to go, or you got to kind of, you know, have you taken any preliminary steps to get this thing rolling?
Oh, yeah, the documents are all ready to go. And I have the lawyer in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, ready to prepare. So we're ready. It's just, it's a matter of time. It's history. And when you deal with history, when you deal with Pearl Harbor, all those stuff, Tim, as you realize being a host for so long on your great show, you have to have a patience with history, Tim. You
Absolutely.
Have to have the funding. And if you don't, you're going to look a fool. And you've got to sit back and relax. And that's why, you know, what I'm doing now is I'm writing other books about other subjects. And when we have, you know what, I'm everything is ready to go. We just have to wait for The Devil in the White City to come out. We've got probably the most expensive movie ever to be made. We've got Hollywood going to spend $30, $40, $50 million in advertising about H.H. Holmes. I'm just going to jump on and ride with it, Tim, when it comes. And then if they do the smart thing and ask me to help them with their story, well, it's, you know, it'll be easy riding, and I think at that point I'll be able to convince the people that have those funds. $100,000 in Hollywood is nothing, Tim.
Right.
You know, as much as I know.
They may want to do it leading into the movie as part of a, you know, sort of generate the publicity and get a buzz going.
Can you imagine Leonardo DiCaprio there watching them do it?
Well, what about this, dude? I don't want to be the guy that's like, I don't want to be super pessimistic, dude, but you know, Hollywood is a fickle place. What if they put all this money into the movie? Like, look at that Steve Jobs movie that just came out this weekend. It was a huge bomb. Like, what if the movie comes out and it's a bomb? Are you gonna be? I presume I'd be pissed. So, I mean, that would kind of throw a lot of water on this in the sense that it's like, geez, the public interest isn't there.
You know, it's funny. I've got a guy selling my book in Hollywood to HBO and AMC, those that stuff, and.
Yeah.
He explained to me how Hollywood works. You don't know how it works, Tim. None of those movies that you're claiming are a bomb lost money. They were all funded by Chinese bonds. They came over. Hollywood didn't have to put a dollar into them. And then even if they don't sell in the States, they're sent worldwide on the disc or whatever they do now. I'm not sure the mechanism or the technology. But even the movies they're claiming now to you that you read are a bomb, they're still making a fortune on.
All right. Fair enough. Okay, so what's this is the wrap-up. What's next for you? What do you got cooking beyond Bloodstains? You say you're working on some other stuff, so what can folks look forward to from Jeff Mudgett?
Oh, yeah, I've got a novel that's coming out soon. It's I've always wanted to write a detective story. When I was a boy, I used to love Raymond Chandler. I used to love any of the James Bond, the John D. McDonald stuff. And I always knew that that was a very tough genre to write. So I wanted to give myself a chance because, let's face it, I've sold thousands and thousands of books, Bloodstains. But it's because of who I am and my platform as the great-great-grandson. Now, I wanted to see if I could write a book that sells because of my ability to write. So I'm putting out a book called Falling in Purple that's a detective novel with a modern-day love story wrapped up inside. And it'll be out here in a couple of weeks, so I'm excited about that, and we'll see how it goes.
Nice. You got a website to direct folks to for that?
Not yet. It hasn't. It's just going to manuscript now. It'll be. We'll get it out to publish pretty soon, and then we'll put a website up. Also, if any of your listeners are interested, I think my manager still has some signed copies of Bloodstains, so that if they are interested in reading the print book, go to that bloodstainsthebook.com and note to my manager, Kelly, that you heard about a signed copy on your show, and I think he's still got some left.
Nice, nice. Yeah, folks, check that out. Check that out. And like I said, Jeff, you should get in touch with this Discovery America. They seem like the type of people who would jump at the opportunity to get involved in this story. They like that kind of stuff. So maybe wait to see how the Exorcism special does. But if it's a big hit, I'd hit them up. I'd be like, hey, man, let's go after this Holmes thing because it could change the face of history.
I'll take you up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, sorry that I anticipated a longer interview, but I appreciate the time that you had the chance to give to us. I really do enjoy the conversation. It feels like you're on the cusp of either a really huge story or something, you know, that's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds.
Hey, Tim, thanks a lot. I enjoyed your show a lot. You're knowledgeable about the subject, and your ability to run the show is admirable. I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, thank you very much, my friend, and have a great evening.
Okay, good night, Tim.
Good night. There you go, folks. There you go. That was Jeff Mudgett. The book is Bloodstains. The website is bloodstainsthebook.com. Check it out. If you're listening to us on Blog Talk Radio, this is Banal of America Audio. You can find out more from us at banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. All kinds of interviews there, over 250, I believe, at this point, with all kinds of folks, covering all kinds of topics in the world of the strange and unusual, UFOs, Bigfoot, conspiracies, ghosts, all that great stuff. And it's all absolutely free, and you can find it, once again, at banalofamerica.com. We're also on Facebook, so just punch in Banal of America and like us. As I said, we have a vast archive at BOA, and it is absolutely free. How do we do that? That's simple. We do it via donations from the Banal of America listeners. You can find out how to help us out, and we'd greatly appreciate it if you could, to head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. That'll bring you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't like doing internet money type stuff, you can always donate via the P.O. Box at Banal of America. The address is at BOA. Let me see. I'm a little thrown off here because we kind of cut the show earlier than expected. So I don't have much else to say. I can't really tell you what we got cooking on the next edition of the program. I got a few ideas of who we'll be talking to. So stay tuned to Banal of America on Facebook and BOA proper for more information about the next edition of the program. I'm going to try and get some shows out to you a little faster than I have over the last few months. But you never know. We'll see what happens down the line. I believe this is episode 926. So we got about 7 shows left here before we wrap up season 9. And then, of course, comes the remarkable BOA Audio season 10. So we're on the cusp of history ourselves here on Banal of America. But like I said, I can't tell you who the next guest will be, but I got a few in the pipeline, so hopefully sometime in the next few days I can announce something for the next edition of Banal of America. With all that said, thank you folks for listening tonight. Thank you so much for your support of the program, the hardcore listeners who've been around forever, and the newcomers who are just discovering BOA. Thank you for your support of the program. It is enormously appreciated. You are the fuel that drives the BOA mothership. And with all that said, thank you once again for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.